Even while the glow of Christmas is still all around us, eating things like fudge for breakfast.
How'd you know?
I know. There's nothing quite like a Christmas cookie and a cup of coffee in the morning, I always say. Even while that warm glow is all around us, we are assigned this text. And this is a troubling text. It was a troubling text in the first months of Jesus' life, and it is a troubling text today. The backstory is very familiar. You remember when the wise men made their way to the following the star, to the manger, Herod, the Roman governor, said to them, "After you find the child, come and tell me where he is that I may go and worship him." Wink, wink. He had no intention of worshiping him. And the wise men, as we will look at next week, went home by a different route and never did locate that child for Herod. Herod, in turn, decides he is really threatened by this story that's circulating of a child Messiah. And as with tyrants, always, he decides to slaughter all the children, all the baby boys, under two, so that the Messiah will be gone and no threat to him. Once again, Joseph learns in a dream. Now, it's a wonder that Joseph didn't develop insomnia. If I were Joseph, I'd never sleep a wink. Every time he goes to sleep, there's a dream, and it tells him to do something else that's even scarier than the last thing in the last dream. But anyway, Joseph learns in a dream that he is to take his family and flee. The text concludes with a reference to Rachel. And this is actually a quotation from the prophet Jeremiah about Rachel weeping. Rachel is not an actual person, but stands for all women. And there was loud lamentation because Rachel was weeping for her children who are no more. So the whole land was covered in weeping. Now, this stark story, which ends with the death of children, is especially disquieting at Christmas time because children are both a source and a recipient of our Christmas joy. My family's at an age where we have people in all age categories, and the children who are as entertained by the boxes and the wrapping paper as they are of the gifts inside, who unapologetically said, "Let's do the presents now. I'm ready." Who say, "What did she get? Did I get one of those?" There's a certain joy there. But despite the disquieting nature of the story, we can't ignore it. And I think there are at least three ideas that come from this story that we want to focus on. First, it is the essential truth that Jesus was born into a brutal world. He was not born into a bucolic pastoral community living in peace on the land. He was born into an occupied territory. He was born in a city where his father was forced to go to register. He was born into a brutal world, and our world today is still brutal. In our own land and throughout the world, families who fear violence and danger still take flight. In the dark of night, seeking only succor and safety and for their children's future. Whatever your view of immigration policy, decency, and may I say Christianity itself requires opposition to policies that punish children or endanger children.
children.
Jesus said, "Suffer the little children to come unto me, and forbid them not, for of such is my kingdom." And so, in this story, we see a connection. There are more refugees on the face of the world today than at any time in human history. Many of them fleeing from danger, hunger, and brutality. When I was a mission worker in Egypt, I visited a church called St. Barbara's. Now, St. Barbara's is the traditional site where the Holy Family resided in Cairo. And I am here to tell you it is a wonder that the Holy Family did not die of consumption. The housing for St. Barbara's is below ground, and it's dank and it's dark. But one of the children, when we were visiting that site, one of the children who was both practicing her English and was being helpful to a stranger said, "Jesus didn't have his own room, neither do I." So those of you who don't have your own room, you're in good company. This harrowing story of the slaughter of the innocents should give us pause. Wherever innocents are in danger, innocence itself is in danger. And when childhood is in danger, the future is in peril. Second, we want a glimpse here, God's transforming power in the story. Poor Joseph and he's got to go to his physician and get something for sleep. He's got to do something about this dream thing. He must have had his doubts. Awaken. Did I really dream that? What's going on with me? Am I losing my mind having these dreams? And did that dream tell me, a Jew, to flee toward Egypt? You know what Egypt is. Egypt is the symbol of our oppression, our humiliation, our slavery of Pharaoh. I am going to run for my life and I'm going to run toward Egypt. For ancient Near Eastern Jews, there is no worse a place than Egypt. What does this story reveal? Is that Jesus can use the worst of places for the best of purposes. He'll prove that again at Calvary. Can use the worst of places. Can we? Can we take whatever situation we are in life and relying on God's grace, find the best in the situation? And I think that's his challenge. Although it's a brutal world, God is active in it and can bring about good in the midst of strife. I've recently finished a book, actually a tome, called The Flight Portfolio. And I commend it to you if the winter months find you indoors and you have a lot of time to read. It's a very thick book, but it's a very wonderful book, I think. It's about a Presbyterian from Ridgewood, New Jersey, named Varian Fry. And Varian Fry graduated from Harvard University in 1939, not with any particular skills, but he had an interest and a degree in art. And he fell in with a group of socialites on the east side of Manhattan that were sometimes joined by Eleanor Roosevelt in their conversation, and they set out. Remember, this is before the United States is in the war. And they set out to save the intellectual Jews of Europe, particularly artists. So they gathered money from their well-to-do friends, and they sent a very inexperienced young man, Varian Fry, to Marseille, France, in Vichy, France. And he and a ragtag bunch of people over the next years found ways to ferret out Jewish artists and intellectuals. Now, this is historical fiction, this particular book. It's based on a true story, but of course the dialogue is fictionalized. But just in case you think it's interesting but not important, here are the people, some of the people, of the 175 people Barium Fry got out of Europe. Hannah Arendt, Max Ernst, Marcel Duchamp, and Marc Chagall. A good day's work. Bringing the best out of the worst of places. Something to remember when you find yourself in the worst of places. A third lesson of this text, it seems to me, is a note that the work of Christmas does not end at the manger. I'm sure you've noticed that taking down the decorations is not nearly as much fun as putting them up. And somehow they grow. And so they don't go back in the boxes you got them out of. I don't know enough science to know exactly how that works. But I have a 50-year history of knowing it to be true. But even that's not the work of Christmas. The work of Christmas is to take the joy and the love that found us at the manger and walking to the ends of the earth with it. Howard Thurman, a wonderful African-American theologian, says it this way in his poem. When the song of the angels is stilled, when the star in the sky is gone, when the kings and princesses are home, when the shepherds are back with their flock, the work of Christmas begins. To find the lost, to heal the broken, to feed the hungry, to release the prisoner, to rebuild the nations, to bring peace among the people, to make music in the heart. That's our challenge this first Christmastide Sunday, to make music in the heart and get on with the work of Christmas. May it be so. Amen.